It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. Looking back at some of my own notes, I've been watching some of the birds at the bird feeder, and I've had quite a bit of variety there where for a long time it was pretty much the same group. Why, in the last week I've had goldfinches, pine siskins, red poles, and of course chickadees naturally, blue jays, pine grosbeaks, and then all of the woodpeckers, not all, but you know, the downy, the hairy, and the pileated woodpeckers have all been at the feeder. I did make a note last Thursday morning. I think I had 35 below zero at my house, which is cool enough. It made your nose kind of burn when you went outside. You didn't have to be out very long for it to get kind of crisp. The nice thing about that cold weather, the thing I enjoyed the most, was the fact that the skies were clear. And, of course, that's usually what happens. Clear skies usually accompany cold weather. But it was just gorgeous out. I mean, the moon was just phenomenal. It was nearly full, and boy, the light was just stunning. And to go outside when it's that cold and the moonlight is that bright, it's just a really magical, magical time. And I had a couple of really nice walks during that time with the dogs, and boy, it was really quite something out there. Just stunning to be out and to see all of that. As I drove around my mail route on those cold days, I noticed most of the birds were pretty well hanging with the bird feeders wherever they could find them. But the ravens were out and digging holes in the snow and finding old roadkill and whatnot, and they can remember where those are. But one pair of ravens, I suppose it's a territorial pair because I see the two of them just about every day, were sitting in a young aspen tree, a tree that wasn't 15, maybe 20 feet tall. And the two of them were sitting within 4 or 5 feet of one another and in the direct sunlight, and they had their feathers just completely erected to hold the heat in. And they looked really shaggy. I mean, all these little feather ends were kind of sticking out individually. It looked to me like, gee, you'd want to kind of close things up a little bit, but they evidently know how to do that, and they were definitely sitting there just soaking up the sunlight. It was probably 20 below zero, and they were enjoying themselves in the sunlight and just sitting in a nice quiet spot, taking things easy. Saw a couple of bald eagles this past week. Used to be, you know, that the bald eagles were definitely not in the area during the winter, but that's not the case anymore. There are bald eagles around here all the time. Year-round, there are bald eagles in the area, so we just have to get used to seeing them. I saw a couple of mourning doves this past week, which is a bit unusual, though I've had a number of reports of mourning doves in the area. I find that if you want mourning doves to come to your feeders, that peanuts are a good food source. They don't really come to the black oil sunflower seeds, but peanuts work, and bread is another excellent attractant for mourning doves if you want to get them to your feeder. But if you do put out bread, be advised that you might end up with some starlings there. Now, the starlings go through quite a shift in plumage, and this time of year they look a bit unusual. They are sort of, rather than just sort of uniformly black, they have these little, what would you call them? I guess crescents of brown at the ends of each of their feathers. And so their overall effect is kind of mottled looking. And they are, of course, an introduced species, and so they're not necessarily well adapted to every situation, but they seem to do pretty well up here. And if you put bread out, oftentimes if there are starlings around, you will find them at your feeder after the bread that you might put out for them. Watch them. If you get some in there, watch them, because this time of year their beaks are going to start turning from black to yellow, which is another one of those optimistic signs of spring. I was out snowshoeing on Sunday and just kind of checking things out, and two really noteworthy things on Sunday. One was the fact that the wind was out of the south, southeast and strong, very strong. And of course, that's what brought in this warm weather that we're having right now. As that warm front moved in, the winds began to blow strong from the south all day. And it caused a lot of the snow that had been hung up in some of the pines and spruce trees around my house to come tumbling down. And so it was an adventuresome day to be out snowshoeing, because back in the woods, why, every once in a while, a big lump of snow would come down and crash into my back or bounce off my shoulder or fall very near me. So it was quite the exciting day. But down low, down at ground level, the wind was not having any effect, and there are some bushes out there that are really pushed over and weighted down, and in some cases, you know, they got bent over because of that ice storm that came along back in early December, late November, I don't remember, but it was a while back anyway, and as a result, those bushes got bent over and weighted down, and snow began to pile up on them, and now it has formed these really significant piles of snow on top of some of this brush. As you're walking through the woods, you will see a lot of little hollows that are kind of down below the level of the snow. And as I inspected some of these, I don't know if it was my eyes, I don't know if it was the ground temperature, but it looked like, you know, frost was forming around some of these openings that delved down into deeper depths of snow, and perhaps the earth below was warm enough to cause some warm air to come out of there and form these kind of crystalline structures along the edge of these holes. Or it might have been wild animals that were down there, but it really looked like an interesting area for those animals like weasels and rabbits and grouse to have plenty of places to hide. One of the things about that whole thing is that I checked snow depths, and wherever I was in country like aspens, when I was in the upland hardwood or aspen forest, birch, maple, aspen, the snow depths were around 24 inches on the ground. And as I moved into Norway pines, it dropped to about 15 inches. And as I got in under the white spruce, it was down to about 10 inches. But still, in all, a lot of snow on the ground out there. And that makes it pretty nice for all those critters that are kind of hanging out under the snow and trying to keep alive. Frogs, you know, all of the wood frogs, spring peepers, hopefully this snow blanket will give them a good warm winter and they'll come out of it really healthy in the spring, and we'll see lots of them around. That would be nice. Other critters that are out there making a good use of this deep snow include the weasels, and we did have some weasel sightings this past week, so always, always, always keep your eyes out for the weasels. They're pretty interesting little critters, and they are out there active every day, looking for a bite to eat. That's our Phenology show for today. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again next week. It's time for TalkBack. TalkBack is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've got a comment you'd like to make, an observation you'd like to share, a question you'd like to pose. It really doesn't matter. We just like to hear from you, and you can get in touch with us by calling our TalkBack line. That number is 999-9876. You can also reach us by email at comments@kaxe.org. And you can always write to us. We love to get your letters. And Dougie, the mailman, he likes to bring them to us. So give us a shout out one way or another and let us know you're listening, and share what you have to share. From Ken Perry, who is the instructor for the Forest View Middle School Bird Club. Here's our report. Jolene has the regulars coming to her feeder, but she really enjoys watching the pileated woodpeckers. And just as an aside, it seems to me that over the past 10 or 15 years, the number of pileated woodpeckers has really jumped. I mean, I can recall in the 80s and early 90s, not seeing a lot of pileated woodpeckers. And now it just seems like every day I can go out and find a pileated woodpecker or more than one around the area. Back to the report. Travis has his regulars at the feeder, plus lots of dark-eyed juncos. Now, the juncos, one year I had juncos stay all winter, but not this year. And I'm surprised. I would think with all this snow that they would be perfectly happy to go further south. I know if I could fly, I'd be further south. Hunter also has the regulars at his feeder, but he is now minus one individual. He was fortunate enough to see a sharp-shinned hawk take a bird from his feeder. Way to go, Hunter. Mr. Perry is also seeing some predatory birds in his yard over the weekend. He had a northern shrike, a sharp-shinned hawk working on the other birds. He also received a report from his friend Bill Blum that he had a pair of pileated woodpeckers mating in his yard on the 22nd. Since this is beyond the typical breeding dates for this bird, we will note it as an optimistic indicator of spring on the way. We also talked about the program Dark Side of the Loon. It will be shown again this Wednesday, the 26th, at the Northland Arboretum in Brainerd at 7 p.m. That's our report for this week. See you outside. Thank you for that great report. And, in terms of optimistic indicators of spring, I've also been listening to the chickadees. And even on the coldest mornings, especially when it's sunny out, they seem to sing that Phoebe song, that cheeseburger song, that kind of, hi, honey. Cheeseburger. Whatever you want, however you'd like to interpret it, they definitely have been singing that song, and that's an optimistic sign of spring as well. We heard from our good friend Joel down in Park Lake, and he said, in the past week, the pine grosbeaks appeared to have reached parity with the evening grosbeaks, with about 18 each visiting regularly. Usually the pine grosbeaks arrive first. On Sunday, I started a new bag of black sunflower seeds, and both species of grosbeaks seemed to show a preference for the older seed. In the last two mornings, the grosbeaks have been far less numerous and persistent. This morning, Monday, many more goldfinches and redpolls have been hanging around the feeder. They don't seem to notice the difference and are probably encouraged by the absence of the larger birds. This is not the first time I've noticed a songbird preference for one batch of black sunflower seeds over another, and in several instances, I've noticed an odor reminiscent of diesel or maybe hydraulic fluid coming from these seeds. Any other bird watchers ever report something like this to you? No, they haven't. And in fact, I haven't really noticed it too much, but I will definitely keep an eye out, and I'll have to put my face down into that brand new bag of black oil sunflower seeds that I bought. I guess it gives new meaning to the oil in black oil sunflower seeds. Friday morning, we hit 37 below, marking the first time since January 17, 2005, we've dropped below 35 below zero. On January 17th, 2005 was the last time we dropped into the minus 40s with a low of minus 48 degrees Fahrenheit. Cold temperatures that used to be fairly commonplace are now a much publicized event accompanied by school closings and buses running 2 hours late. In 1996, if schools closed for minus 30 and colder, we'd have had 13 days where the kids stayed home due to the cold. That from Joel down in Park Lake. And yeah, I got to go along with Joel. Things are getting bad. Kids are getting soft. Why? When I was a kid, if the bus was full, they just stuck your tongue to the bumper and drove you to school. You got to be tough. We heard from a guy from Lavinia, which is over near Bemidji, and he has a brown creeper hanging around his place.
I had a brown creeper, 17 January, that has been in my yard here, eaten, and they're not supposed to be here. And I'd say I saw it in December, but it's still here, January 17. Thank you very much.
Hey, I suppose you could send it over to the neighbor's house. Actually, brown creepers, this part of Minnesota is one of those areas where the brown creepers are kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Indigenous, I guess. They're year-round residents. They sometimes extend just slightly north of the border into Canada, and they spend a lot of their time south of us in the winter. But actually, there is a population of brown creepers that, whether they migrate down from up north and spend the winter here, or they just don't bother to migrate at all and spend the winter here, I don't know. But I do know that brown creepers are not common. They are uncommon, and they prefer spruce, tamarack, balsam, kind of a, you know, that boreal forest sort of area. So if you're in an area where you have more hardwoods, you're probably not as likely to see a brown creeper, though occasionally they show up. And around my house, I see a brown creeper every couple of months or so, and it's always a thrill to see that little brown bird. And they are very, very clever at hiding when they want to. We got an email. You may recall last week we were talking about beaver ponds that drained, the water drains out underneath them. And Harry had mentioned during our conversation that he had seen something like that. And Bill Berg responded with this note. He said, the dry mid-70s caused lots of concern about low water and beaver survival, so much that the DNR trimmed back the beaver season substantially, in part due to the DNR forestry's concerns about fire danger and no beaver ponds from which to scoop up water. We, the DNR, did several flights and saw many examples of both caved-in ice on beaver ponds and ponds that were partly dry with still intact ice shelves, which was hollow beneath the ice. Because some cases feed piles were not available, beavers traveled overland through the snow to cut down a new tree, and sometimes coyotes actually caught and killed the vulnerable beavers. This was before wolves had displaced coyotes over most of northern Minnesota, and the wolves would have made a far bigger dent in beaver numbers. But each beaver wears its own fur coat, and in general, they survived. They are capable of surviving droughts and blown dams just fine. Have fun with this, Bill. Thanks, Bill. Always good to hear from you and kind of clear up some of those mysteries that come along. We also heard this week from our good friends, the students of Mr. Holmes' fifth grade in Roosevelt Elementary School in Virginia, and our reporter this week is Bill.
The coldest temperature that anyone in the classroom reported last week was negative 37 degrees in Britain. Even the kids in my class that usually forget their hats and gloves and boots did not forget them on Friday morning. There's an open spot in Silver Lake by the steam plant, and a few ducks and a muskrat can be seen swimming in the water if you stop to look. Michaela reports that a deer got hit on the highway, and while it was laying there, another car hit it again, and there were guts all over the place. One cold morning last week, Kiana found a bottle of bubbles stuff and went outside and blew a few. She reports that they fell to the ground, and she was able to pick them up with her fingers. Bill threw a cup of hot water in the air on Sunday morning, and sure enough, it seems way before it hits the ground. Bo's brother put Bo's new metal water bottle filled with water outside overnight, and the frozen water even broke the hard metal. Jake saw on TV, if you freeze a banana outside in the cold, you can use it to hammer a nail. He tries it, and sure enough, that works too. Jackson saw a white weasel with a mouse in its mouth. Skylar Webb lives in Pikes Township. The last weekend, she followed moose tracks on her driveway to a spot on Pike River where the moose had fallen through. Chloe reports that she and her bro built a snow fort on Saturday, and they plan to spray it with cold colored water when they were done, but the water froze in the bottle before they could get to that part done. This is the report for this week. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Nice job. And boy, lots of things out there. A cup of hot water thrown in the air, freezing before it lands. That's always a fun experiment. You know, I've tried that a couple times myself. and a metal bottle filled with water left out overnight breaks the bottle. What's the lesson there? Ice expands. And it's a good thing it does, too. We'd be in a different sort of a world if ice sank. Believe me, we probably wouldn't be in this world. Things would have developed differently. A weasel with a mouth, a mouse in its mouth, a mouth in its mouth. That's a tough one. I talked to a friend of mine yesterday who had a weasel kind of trapped out in an area. He snowblows trail back to his, he's got a shed in the back there, and the weasel got trapped along the trail, and it kept trying to get up the bank. And the snowblower, I mean, if you're like he and I, both of us have been snowblowing for a while this winter, and the banks are getting pretty steep and kind of straight up and down. And this weasel tried several times to jump up that bank and didn't quite make it ever. So it finally ran down the trail a ways and found a different place where it could get out. But it's always fun to see weasels this time of year. And that little black tip on their tail, scientists, you know, they thought, why on earth would the weasel have a black tip on its tail? Why, you know, what's the purpose of that? Here's an all-white animal that would blend perfectly with the snow and be perfectly safe if it didn't have that black tip on its tail, but it does. So they did some research, and they found out that the black tip on the tail of the weasel oftentimes sends its predators, owls, hawks, that kind of thing, to the wrong end of the weasel. And they come swooping down there thinking they're going to grab the weasel, and all they get is a little bit of his tail, and he just slithers out, you know. It's like they close their feet down around that little tail of his, and he just slides right out of there and gone. So it has its purpose. And obviously, it's one of those evolutionary things where I suppose those weasels without the black tips didn't fare as well. And so all of a sudden, all the weasels have black tips on their tails. Our good friend Jack from over in the Bemidji area sent along this note. He said, yesterday we had wild E. coyote out on the thin ice behind the house chasing four ravens that had found something of interest frozen in the ice. The ravens would move aside, then one would return and taunt Wile E, and when distracted, one of the others would dive on him while the remaining would try for whatever prize was in the ice. The little dance lasted perhaps 10 minutes, and then Wile E decided to move on for better picking. I was afraid he might fall through the thin ice. He, too, seemed to sense the danger that might be lurking beneath him. I'm glad to see the coyote in the neighborhood. They keep the rabbit population under control. Last year, we found scat that we didn't recognize in the driveway, which was most certainly coyote. That from our good friend Jack. And boy, I'll tell you, ravens and those poor coyotes and wolves, they're just no match. I mean, the birds can outthink them every time. Our final phone call this week comes from the Northern Lights Community School in Warba, and our reporter this week is Amanda.
The temperature this morning at school is 10 degrees. It is much warmer than last week. Today, the high is supposed to get to 18 degrees, and the low is negative 8 degrees. This weekend was very cold. The wind was blowing very hard and blew snow and ice off of the trees. Jordan had blackbirds on her car. A lynx was spotted near Marble, and Lori has rabbits living under her porch. Thank you for listening to the Warba Phenology Report.
Thank you, Amanda. Nice job. And that wraps up our Phenology Talkback segment for this week. If you have a comment, question, or an observation you'd like to share, please send it along.
You're listening to Phenology Plus on KAXE, Community Radio for Northern Minnesota, 91.7 on the Iron Range, Inger, and Ideal Corners, 89.9 in the Brainerd area, and 105.3 in Bemidji. Audio streaming on the internet at kaxe.org. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Coming up, we'll hear about an organization that is working to preserve sensitive shoreline areas in Cass, Hubbard, and Beltrami counties. Also, on A Talk on the Wild Side, John and Harry Hutchins talk about sporadic sightings of evening grosbeaks, and Harry tells us about some places you can combine skiing and looking for wildlife. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Atchison Tire Company in Grand Rapids. Locally owned for more than 90 years, Atchison Tire has offered new tires and repair services for generations of their customers online at atchisontire.com. We also have support from the Bonner Eye Clinic in Grand Rapids. At the Bonner Eye Clinic, Drs. Bonner, Mariano, and Kincannon have served the eye care needs of Grand Rapids, Itasca County, and the Iron Range for over 45 years. Located at 1542 Golf Course Road, the Bonner Eye Clinic is proud to support KAXE, authentic local radio. The annual Sacs-Zim Bog Festival of Birds is the weekend of February 18th through the 20th. Highlights of this year's festival include programs by wildlife photographer Paul Bannock and bog naturalist Sparky Stensis, as well as numerous field trips into the bog looking for the unique assortment of owls and other birds that inhabit the Sacs-Zim Bog. The Meadowlands Community Center is festival headquarters. The registration deadline is next Monday, January 31st, and it's limited to the first 150 people. Call KAXE for more information, 218-326-1234. Every fall, about a dozen conservation organizations in Minnesota, including 1,000 Friends of Minnesota, Minnesota Waters, and the DNR Non-Game Wildlife Program, recognize people and organizations that are doing innovative things to conserve shoreline habitat and protect the water quality of our lakes and streams. Last year's recipient of the Lake Friendly Protection Strategy Award was the Leech Lake Watershed Foundation. The foundation was honored for working closely with Cass County to create incentives for property owners to use conservation easements on shoreline properties to limit development on sensitive shoreline areas. Paula West is the executive director of the Leech Lake Watershed Foundation.
The Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation is a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to protect the short language, the water, woods, and wildlife of the Leech Lake watershed. You know, every lake has its own what we call lake shed, the area of land that drains into the lake, but every lake is also part of a larger watershed, and so our focus is on the Leech Lake watershed itself, and that encompasses 855,000 acres, most of Cass County, the western third of Hubbard County, and just a small part of Beltrami County. And it's a very resource-rich area with over 600 lakes. And our primary focus is protecting shorelines through various conservation actions.
You know, I've talked to Lake Association folks over the years, and they talk about how hard it is to organize 50 or 60 people living around a lake, and this is a huge geographic area, this watershed. How do you begin to organize the people who live within the watershed?
Well, we work closely with the local lake associations. You know, they're the real action-oriented people on the ground, and so it's really a collaborative effort. We provide a lot of technical assistance and educational assistance. We're also very active in land acquisition and land protection projects that we can coordinate for the lake associations and actually acquire land ourselves. But they're the people who steer us to the appropriate properties, and we work very closely hand-in-hand with not only the lake associations but also the Cass County Association of Lake Associations. So it's really a collaborative effort, and it seems to work very well. We're making great strides on conservation in Cass County in particular.
Yeah, and we've heard a lot over the years about how really advanced Cass County with its Environmental Services Office working with those lake associations have developed some innovative programs. This award for the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation was for developing a strategy to create conservation easements on shoreline properties that have been identified as sensitive. How far along are you in identifying some of those places?
Well, let me just step back a second, Scott, and say, you know, one of our strategies is to sustain the quality of our lakes, and And I think that lake sustainability is made up of two actions. One, where you have undeveloped shoreline that is very important ecologically for fish and wildlife habitat and to protect water quality, then we try to find the best of the best of those sensitive shorelines and keep them undeveloped. But where we already have developed shorelines, the best strategy for sustainability is for those property owners to use best management practices, you know, shoreline buffers, making sure their septic systems are working correctly, minimizing the runoff, and those kinds of things. So our focus is primarily on the undeveloped shorelines. And what the foundation has done with Cass County back in 2008, we mapped over 60 lakes in Cass County for what we called parcels of high conservation potential. And that was based on the amount of shoreline and the amount of adjacent acreage to the parcels. And in essence, it was the largest parcels that were still undeveloped. And on those 60 lakes, we identified over 1,400 parcels that represented 228 miles of shoreline that are considered high-quality, you know, shorelines that have some potential to be protected. Then to kind of narrow that range down a little bit, because you can see that's kind of massive, the DNR had been working on a pilot project in Cass County for the last couple of years to identify sensitive shorelines. Those are the shorelines that are the most ecologically important to protect for fish and wildlife habitat and water quality. And they used a number of different parameters, and they surveyed 19 lakes in Cass County and actually identified the sensitive shorelines there. And that kind of narrowed down the field to 83 miles of sensitive shoreline. And so we have been focusing some conservation efforts on those 83 miles of sensitive shoreline that have been actually identified by scientific methodology. It isn't, you know, we're not just randomly going around and saying, oh, yeah, that one needs to be protected and that one needs to be protected. We're trying to identify the best of the best so that we're getting the most bang for the buck. And one of the programs that we've been working on, in addition to some of the land acquisition projects that the foundation's involved in, is we have collaborated with Cass County on currently a grant from the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, sometimes referred to as LCCMR. And that's our lottery money that goes to the environment. And what we will do is for individual property owners who own these sensitive shorelines, if they are interested in putting a conservation easement on their property, we will pay the closing costs through this grant and also stewardship costs if necessary. And so it takes sort of the out-of-the-pocket costs away for the landowner who's willing to put some protections on their lakeshore.
Well, now give us an example of maybe one or two of the areas you've identified. What are they like?
Well, they're these sensitive areas. I mean, they may have a lot of bulrushes or other emergent vegetation. Maybe a lot of wild rice. They're places where fish spawn. They're, you know, natural native vegetated shorelines. They're areas where a lot of wildlife, you know, may nest, where loons may be nesting, other wildlife that depend on the shoreline. You know, 90% of all the critters that rely on our lake shore, our lake systems, live in that shoreland zone. So, you know, it's not, it may have been a scientific process, but intuitively, as you go around the lake, most people who live on lakes would probably be able to identify a lot of these areas themselves. They're areas where there's a lot of vegetation. And, you know, sometimes we think about vegetation as being weeds that we don't want, but that vegetation is very vital to the lake itself. The bulrushes are so important for fish spawning. They filter out nutrients that can impair water quality. They protect the shorelines from erosion. So that's just kind of a snapshot of what these sensitive shorelines might look like. And, You know, we in Cass County in particular, there's still a lot of shorelines. About 40% of the shoreline on the major lakes is not developed, contrary to what you might see in the Crow Wing County area.
We're speaking with Paula West. She's the executive director of the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation, and they were last year given a Lake Friendly Protection Strategy Award from some area conservation organizations that have their annual awards for lakescaping and lake protection, lake stewardship awards. And Paula, I know before you were with the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation, you worked for many years with lake associations directly. And how do you think we're coming along in terms of getting people at the grassroots level to understand what we mean by managing lands for water protection, water quality, as well as those wildlife and aesthetic values? Would you say we've made a lot of progress? Do we have a long way to go? How would you rate that?
I think we're making progress. I wouldn't say we've made, you know, giant strides, but slowly but surely people, not only people who live on lake shores, but even local governments, Cass County in particular is very progressive, have, you know, noted that it's important to protect these shorelines to maintain the water quality that we have. I see more and more people that are, you know, interested in putting shoreline buffers in or restoring the native shoreline vegetation along their lakeshore and realizing that it's, you know, it provides a lot of benefit. It reduces the runoff and protects the water quality. So, you know, it's a slow process, Scott. It's a lot of education, but the lake associations are doing an excellent job, you know, educating their members, and we provide information too, and it's just, it takes time, but I think there's a tremendous commitment to it here. I mean, as evidenced by the fact that almost 60% of the voters in November of 2008 voted for the new constitutionally dedicated sales tax increase, even in the midst of all of our economic struggles, that people in Minnesota care about their lakes. There's no question.
Paula, after our interview, you're heading out to go to work. What are some things on your agenda today?
Well, this time of year, it's a little slower because the lake associations aren't so active, and most of our time meeting with people comes during the active lake season. But I'm busy writing some grants right now to continue to support our work. I continue to build partnerships with other organizations. We work not only collaboratively with lake associations, but also with obviously the local governments in our watershed, but also other nonprofits around the state who have conservation goals. So it's always, you know, looking for funds to sustain our organization and building partnerships to work more effectively, developing new educational materials. That's kind of what we're involved in right now. And I would like to tell people about these conservation easements. If you're a shoreline property owner and you are in one of these sensitive shoreland areas, you can certainly call our office and we can discuss that. We do have these grants available, and we're also have been recommended for additional funding by the Lessard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council, which is the council that oversees the one-third of the new sales tax that goes for habitat protection. We're waiting for legislative approval right now. But that will expand this program of offering financial incentives for conservation easements, not only to landowners in Cass County, but also landowners in Crow Wing and Aiken County. So starting to branch out a little more regionally in protecting these sensitive shorelines throughout the whole North Central region, which I know your listening area covers.
Yeah. Paula West, thanks for telling us about the Leech Lake Area Watershed Foundation's work, and congratulations on that Lake Friendly Protection Strategy Award. It's another good way to highlight some of the important work you're doing. Thank you for being on our program.
Well, thank you, Scott, and our phone number is 218-675-5773. Have a great day.
You too. And if you didn't write that phone number down, I have the phone number here at the station. If you want more information, call us too, 218-326-1234. Time now for a talk on the wild side with John Latimer and Harry Hutchins. Harry is a forest ecologist. He teaches in the forestry program at Itasca Community College. And in this conversation, John and Harry talk about the sporadic sightings of evening grosbeaks, and Harry tells us about some good trails to ski and see wildlife.
There's been a lot of talk about evening grosbeaks and
yeah.
the lack thereof.
Where are
but,
they?
One of my colleagues over at the college said he has them every year, and that's, I think he lives kind of over by that Calumet area, by the Big Ridge ski trail type thing. And another one said he had his first batch this weekend after about 7 years. So, and he lives over by Moose Lake in the Deer River area, so just north of Grand Rapids. Deer Lake, Moose Lake region.
They seem to be around. We always have reports. I have a friend in Cook or Cherry who always has a flock at his place, and Joel Rosen has some this year down in Park Lake. So they're around, but boy, it's not like it used to be.
Yeah.
Back in the 80s.
Oh, man, you couldn't keep the sunflower.
No. It's a good thing in those days that sunflower seeds were about $5 a 50-pound bag, and you could just go down and get another bag because they could eat a bag in a week,
yeah,
10
yeah.
days at the most, you know, if you had a decent flock.
Yeah,
and they'd be there all day long squabbling over the seeds. It was pretty entertaining to watch.
And I thought I'd give my best tips for looking at birds while skiing. Anyways, Stony Ridge, which is up north of Nashwauk, about 18 miles, and on Highway 65, that's probably one of the, if you want to see northern species like gray jays and fisher and moose, things like that, for Itasca County, that's the best one. It's about 10K of skiing. It's flat, relatively flat, and a little bit of up and downs to make it interesting. And about 10K, so you can spend a good afternoon or morning out there, and highly recommended if you want to see a variety of wildlife, a variety of forest types out there, and different age classes. So pretty neat. And then in town, in Grand Rapids, those of you that are here for, I was just maybe a week or so ago, I bumped into some people from Hermantown, and they had come over here and just to ski in the county. So
nice.
And anyways, if you're looking for something in town because you rented a hotel or something and you need some time to get some exercise, I recommend Portage Park, which is 5K, and you can get on that over at the soccer baseball fields there over in Cohasset and Portage Park and start there, and that takes you right along the river.
I was going to ask if it went down along the river, because you could stand a chance of seeing some trumpeter swans down there, couldn't you?
Correct.
And plenty of other waterfowl as well. There's always a group that hangs out there on the river.
Right, and it is open, as open can be. Once you got down into the woods and you go through a lot of balsam fir, aspen, and some maple oak, and there's even a few leatherwood shrubs in there and things like that. And there's some big pines and kind of a nice mixture. And one stretch, one side of that, it's kind of a big rectangle. It still takes you along some of the old railroad grades that have really been colonnaded heavy by balsam fir. And then you move along into the more open country, go over a little hump up Pakegama quartzite, and a nice view down the river, and then you travel along the river all the way back. It's highly recommended. So if you want to look, take your binoculars, and if you want to look at waterfowl, there's stuff there now, and there's golden eyes, and there's mallards, and Canada geese. I didn't see any trumpeter swans this time, but I have in the past, and I'm sure that, you know, as the days move on now, we'll start to see a few more things move in.
Yeah, that, and you know, becoming familiar with those trails this time of year wouldn't be such a bad idea, because come late March, early April, and coming into April, you'll be able to go down there and see like hooded mergansers and wood ducks, and everybody will be gathering there on the river, waiting for the lakes to open up. So it'll be a pretty exciting time. I've been down there a number of times in the spring, and it's always a lot of fun and plenty of things to look at.
One thing I notice now, as opposed to walking there in May, it's quiet.
Oh,
I don't
yeah.
hear the road traffic for whatever reason. And then finally, you want a short trail, short flat trail. MPNL is another place where you're going to be able to see otter, and you're going to be able to see some of the waterfall that we just talked about. It's a real, real good area there. And you might have to break off the trail a little bit here and there to get some good views of the river. But most of a good part of it does go along the river. And of course, that trail is also lighted.
That's a nice little trail and easy to get to.
But I found that using it at night, you don't see a lot of animals.
but they see you, Harry.
I have seen great horned owls there. So
good, yeah.
So you might see a nice owl. Anyways, just a few tips there. There are grosbeaks around. There are places to ski that are relatively flat and take you along those water areas. Or if you want a good northern woods experience in the county, and a good variety of wildlife, I highly recommend planning a day to Stony Ridge, at least an afternoon or morning.
All right.
I noticed a few things in wildlife news and wildlife journals and things like that I thought I'd report upon. And one of them was, John, that we talk a little bit here and there about this tar sand stuff. And these tar sands, of course, are up in Alberta. And in the boreal forest is where a lot of the mining of them is going on right now. And I got a couple of comments I want to make. First off, they were talking about it in one of my wildlife journals or magazines that are related to that are from the Society of Wildlife Management Managers and Wildlife Society, I should say. And this tar sand pollution by heavy metals is becoming a pretty big issue up there. And what they're finding is that these communities up there in the Athabasca River often are having a lot of heavy metals. Ones that you have heard about in the past, of course, lead, copper, nickel, mercury, selenium. And some of these are really concentrated in the river downstream from these operations.
Now, Harry, is this a mining operation, is this taking the oil out of the tar sands operation? Which are you referring to in the tar sands in Alberta?
Taking the...
Removing the oil?
Right.
From the
but
sand?
It is a mining operation.
Yeah.
Because they suck it out of the...
They dig up the sand and they process
so it's
it.
A kind
they
of,
take the forest away and then they go after the oil locked up in the tar sands. Correct.
Okay.
That's a big issue that now that they're looking at, because those communities along there are having to deal with that polluted water. And, of course, those are heavy metals and pretty serious stuff, what age you are.
Nothing you'd want in your system.
No. And they're hard to get rid of.
That's right.
And so there's another consequence to this besides eliminating the forest. I think one of the things I want to mention, though, too, is that it's us. I mean, those companies wouldn't go up there and do that and spend that kind of money for that intensive work that it takes to get that resource out of there unless we demanded it. And so it's the consumers, and we can't just sit here and blame the oil companies, energy companies for going after this. But there are some consequences, obviously, and besides the impact on the forest and the birds and all the other stuff that's up there in the boreal forest, there's also an impact on the humans that live around there directly, and it's a pretty serious situation.
Harry Hutchins is a forest ecologist, and if you have a comment or question or topic you would like John and Harry to discuss on A Talk on the Wild Side, call our talkback line 999-9876. Our email address is comments@kaxe.org. Earlier this month, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the DNR conducted a statewide survey of trumpeter swans. The survey count was more than twice the number counted 5 years ago. DNR wildlife biologist Pam Perry told Kathy Dodge and me that those numbers are a result of a 30-year effort to bring the swan back to Minnesota.
This is a great, great success story. Every 5 years, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service coordinates a survey of all of North America on how trumpeter swans are doing, and Minnesota's part of that. We came up with over 5,000 trumpeter swans counted. In 2005, when it was done, there were about 2,000. So the number has really increased for a species that 30 years ago you really couldn't find in Minnesota.
And I know there was an intensive research effort to try to bring them back many years before that. Is there any other explanation for why the numbers have gone up so much?
They're doing well. I think that's one of the reasons. And they're not hunted. They're not persecuted, really, in any way. So if they have appropriate habitat, they can expand quite a bit. But this was an effort started by the Three Rivers Park District in 1979. They began releasing trumpeter swans, and then the DNR joined in through the Non-Game Wildlife Program in the mid-1980s. And there was a lot of effort done by volunteers and people working, professional biologists as well. The DNR's part, we had people, and this was coordinated through Carol Henderson, who actually went up to Alaska. And he got help from pilots from Northwest Airlines at that time, as they were called, to collect eggs of trumpeter swans. We brought them back to Minnesota, hatched them, and raised them at Carlos Avery Game Farm near Forest Lake, and then started releasing them when they got old enough to be released. And so it was just a big effort, and they've done well. And I think we really need to celebrate some of our success stories.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking so much about invasive species, and kind of we feel like we're under assault almost from things coming from the outside. And now this is a real good success story. Do we have any idea how many trumpeter swans might have been here before all the hunting and the decimation of their populations?
No.
Yeah,
no.
I didn't think
so. Except that they're mentioned in the early historical records, but there weren't any surveys done to actually get numbers. We just know that they were here when the early settlers came into Minnesota in the 1800s. The trumpeters were highly sought after because they'd feed a whole family, a settler family, big, largest waterfowl species in North America. They were big and white, and they were out there on either a lake, a shallow lake, or a big wetland, and they just were sought after. And so they were there, and then by the late 1800s, 1880s, 1890, all of them were gone from Minnesota, and they were really pushed into very remote areas. For example, in Montana, up in the mountains, there was a population, and then in Alaska. So they were very vulnerable to that kind of hunting, I guess, was the main thing.
You know, we've talked so much in the last 20 years about rebuilding the waterfowl habitat, and not just for the swans, but mainly for ducks and migrating birds and waterfowl like that. Is the waterfowl habitat for the swans more stable, say, than for the other migrating waterfowl?
That's a good question. Because it does overlap. It's similar, and I think the efforts that we're doing for other waterfowl species are also benefiting the trumpeter swans. Trumpeters use wetlands. They use larger, shallow lakes. I don't know, but we do have a lot of effort going into working on waterfowl habitat overall, and you know, that's a good thing. I think restoring wetlands, restoring that for water quality and for wildlife is a big deal here in Minnesota.
Where are the swans now?
Great question. Where are they now? In Minnesota, we have a lot that overwinter in Minnesota. In fact, that number that was counted, that's the first week of January, that's over 5,000. Let's see, the exact number was 5,362 swans. first week of January. Those are in Minnesota. They estimate about 600 migrate out of the state. They also estimate that a few hundred from Canada migrate into Minnesota. The largest concentration of them in the state is at Monticello, and this is a spectacular viewing area. If people want to go see a couple thousand trumper swans, they actually have a public viewing area in Monticello on the Mississippi River. You can go on the Monticello website, get instructions, directions on how to get there, but it's worth going to see. The rest of them are at different locations around the state. For example, here in the Brainerd Lakes area, between Brainerd, Pillager, Cross Lake, on the rivers, primarily below dams where there's open water, we counted 334 swans just in this area. And that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot to have in an area that, for the winter here in Minnesota. And those were counted by Mike Loss, who works for our DNR wildlife section. And he was out. He volunteered to go do all this work and check out these locations below the Sylvan Dam, below the Pillager Dam, the Gull Dam, Cross Lake, and all that. There were also quite a few swans counted over in the Ottertail County area in western Minnesota, and then also along the St. Croix River. So those are all some locations. Mm-hmm. But you got to have some open water for them because that's how they get to food.
What are they eating?
They're eating aquatic vegetation. But at Monticello, they're being fed. They do have feeding stations there where they put out corn. And that's one of the reasons why there's such a big concentration there. And it's also downriver from Becker where the power plant is. And so the water's warmed. There's a lot of open water there. And then they do feed them there. But the other birds that are out at other locations are eating aquatic vegetation.
Pam Perry is a wildlife biologist with the DNR. For information about the trumpeter swan recovery in Minnesota, visit the Minnesota DNR website or call KAXE 326-1234. And Pam will host a program called The Dark Side of the Loon in Winter, tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock at the Northland Arboretum in Brainerd. Program will cover where loons go in the winter, what challenges they face, and include a 43-minute film entitled The Dark Side of the Loon. The program is free and open to anyone with an interest in birds. Call KAXE for more information. You can listen to this edition of Phenology Plus and archived programs on the Phenology page, and that's at our website, kaxe.org. Phenology Plus is made possible by our listener members and by Dale's Auto Body in Grand Rapids. At Dale's Auto Body, customer satisfaction is based on 25 years of experience. The staff at Dale's is ready and willing to answer questions concerning the repair and estimating process. At Dale's Auto Body, repairs are vital to a vehicle's performance, safety, and resale value. We also have support from the Itasca Surgical Clinic of Grand Rapids. At the Itasca Surgical Clinic, patients are provided with personal screening, diagnosis, and treatment of a full range of medical conditions, all in a caring environment. That's Phenology Plus for this week. Theme music for Phenology Plus is by Bella Fleck and the Flecktones and Weather Report. I'm Scott Hall with John Latimer. Thanks for listening.